Thanks very much. So this expert address, I've put in a question mark after the road to collective intelligence. So it's also asking the question, can we get there? And what I'm hopefully will go through this evening is a possible scenario of getting there. And what's motivated me is the concept of data disruption. So we've heard about data disruption more recently, and I'm using that as a mechanism to motivate how we get to collective intelligence. So this will be a bit of a journey through my thinking of the bringing the two together. So imagine starting a taxi company, but you have no vehicles. Imagine trying to start a hotel, but with no rooms, ever. Imagine also if you already operated a traditional taxi company or a hotel service. What would you do? Two things you can do. Well, you could fight them, these new business models that come along. And that's what happens in some scenarios. So this is the in Paris. The taxi driver's rioting against a well-known taxi service startup company. So you could fight them and see whether you win. And that reminds me of, you know, in previous sort of scenarios where a new technology is being fought by the establishment, and typically they don't win. In the area, I used to work in the area of digital rights management, and the big music studios, the big record studios fought tooth and nail against any form of technology that enabled the consumer to have a choice. And what happened was, of course, that the consumer won. So you can fight them or you can join them. So here's an interesting slide I found, some data. This is the average trips per car, taxi trips per car in San Francisco. And you can see the effect that Uber's had from approximately 1,400 rides per vehicle, per taxi per month, down to close to 400, so 1,000 less trips a month. So imagine if you're a taxi driver in San Francisco, you would not be happy. The Hilton Hotel, it's been established now for about 90 years. It's got approximately 610,000 rooms, and it's in 88 countries. Airbnb has been around for 4 years. It's got 650,000 rooms. It's in 192 countries. And it's got no inventory. It doesn't have to worry about big buildings full of rooms, maintaining them, insuring them, building new ones, etc. So that's some interesting things to think about as we think about data disruption. How can that have occurred? You know, how could we get to this scenario here when this is what we thought the world looked like, but this is what's happening now? And that's, of course, what data disruption is, one of the outcomes of data disruption. So I always like to ask myself sometimes the bigger question, the big why question. Why did these disruptive services start? These Airbnbs, your Ubers, and there's hundreds of other examples of it. Was it out of frustration? Was it out of someone seeing a business opportunity? Was it enabled by technology? Of course, the answer is it's a combination of all three of those. And we, of course, being an IT person, we look at sort of like the IT or the technology side. How did that enable these sort of services? And the good question to always ask is, does technology always do this? Does technology always enable things? So I read a very good article recently by Kintara Tuomi, I probably pronounced his name wrong as well, and he sort of presented an interesting view on technology. He said that technology does not add a fixed benefit. So if you just look at technology in general, even if for a startup, disruptive startup company, it never adds a sixth benefit. What it actually does is it amplifies underlying human forces. So it takes something small and amplifies it to something bigger. So it doesn't always do a fixed step, doesn't always give you a fixed step, but it amplifies. And I think that's a good paradigm to think about for some of the technology enablers in the data disruption world, this amplification. So what he was trying to say in that sort of piece was that amplification is good and not so good. So it can be good in some scenarios, so you can have free speech in a country, and it can do the negative, which can spread misinformation in another country. But simply using technology, because it amplifies human nature or human forces. So if you want to do bad things with it, you can, and it'll make it worse. And if you want to do good things with it, you can, and it'll make it hopefully better. So it's always good to keep that in that balance of the amplification of technology. And he started off by, and he ends the quote by saying, amplification reaffirms human agency to cause meaningful change. And I thought that was a very nice quote that we can use to sort of motivate some of these discussions. So let's look at that a bit more. Let's look at that again. So amplification reaffirms human agency to cause meaningful change. So what does this mean in data disruption? So Rachel Botsman is a well-known speaker on data disruptive services, and this is one of her slides, one of her eye diagrams from her slides. And she talks about some of the drivers, if you like, for data disruption, like your Ubers and your Airbnbs. Why did they occur? So she looks at things like shared access, being able to share. You've got a resource, whether it's your room in your house or whether it's your car in your garage. How can you share that better? So that's a motivation, if you like, sharing resources. There's the direct ability, which is trying to get people, consumers, closer to the resource they want. So cutting out the middle layer. So giving the consumer direct access to a particular service provider. There's simplicity, another sort of amplification. You want to make things simpler, not harder. And most of the things like you checking in and checking out of a hotel room I'm still flabbergasted how long it takes to check into a hotel room. And I don't understand why it takes so long to check into a hotel room. But it's still there. Empowerment. So empowering the consumer to make choices. The consumer has a say now. We can empower the consumer. So we can amplify the consumer's voice. And efficiency, you know, making the system work better. You know, and I'm sure that, you know, if you ran a hotel with no hotel rooms, you'll be a lot more efficient than if you ran a hotel with hotel rooms, the cost of, and the overheads, etc. So these are all sort of drivers for amplification that she talks about that's helping the data disruption world sort of meet their particular goals and principles. Another way of looking at this from another sort of a commentator in the space was to rethink how value is created. So Airbnb, for example, allows anyone, literally anyone with a spare mattress, and you can have a spare mattress in your back room, or in your garage to make money. So it's rethinking what is value, what's valuable to someone. You may not think that your garage is valuable to you, apart from housing your car, but if you put a mattress in it, put an Airbnb, someone will find value in it. So it's rethinking what value creation is. Rethinking value consumption is another sort of motivating as well. It actually, typically, people, it's not common for travellers to sort of just turn up at some stranger's apartment and say, hey, can I stay here for the night? That typically wasn't common. But now, of course, it is common. I mean, people use Airbnb and other services quite a lot. So the way consumers consume services has changed. So Airbnb has changed the behaviour of the consumer now that it's acceptable to go to instead of Airbnb location. And there's reasons for that. We'll see that a bit later as well. Then there's rethinking quality control. You know, hotels, big hotels, you know, five-star hotels are renowned for their quality, service quality and the reliability of the customer experience. Whereas, you know, Airbnb, as an example, says, well, you know, that may be true, and you pay a premium for that, but these types of services rely on peer quality. So the people who use the, those services are the ones that curate feedback, if you like, that enables you to see whether you're going to get a quality service at a particular Airbnb place or not, or the opposite. So it's rethinking quality control. Quality control doesn't mean you have to go to a six-star hotel. It just means you go to a place where other people have given you good feedback that you will get a good quality service from there. And then, of course, there's rethinking scale. So, you know, adding new rooms to a traditional hotel, very costly, very expensive. Adding new rooms to Airbnb, almost frictionless. You know, almost zero cost to add new rooms to Airbnb. So that last one there about scale, Airbnb is an example. One of the ways it can prove its scale is that its ability to match users, right, or customers to offerings. You know, people who want to find a particular room, those who want to offer a room, by leveraging better data. No, they're actually using better quality data because they need to make better decisions, particularly the consumer. And that's, of course, where the data disruption side comes in. You really need to focus on good data if you're going to disrupt an industry. And one of those is the better matching, better data scenario. So the better data you've got, the better way that you can offer that service. So looking at Uber as an example, and they've got an architecture for their data services where they look at what they call in-flight, which is an existing taxi service or existing taxi booking that's going on. And they're trying to look into the future as to what other taxi trips that particular car can actually take. And they utilise, you know, data such as, you know, geospatial data. I won't go into a lot of detail there, but it's like using Google Maps, but in a much more finer detail. And they can actually sort of map out the location where a particular Uber driver is and work out a better route, as well as work out how that person could actually multi-trip, that he take on multiple people on the same trip. So what they try and do is, in their sort of algorithms, is try and work out if typically you pick up one person and then you drop them off, can you pick up one person, drop them off, but in between pick up another person and then drop them off somewhere else, which is that other scenario at the far end there. So that, of course, is much more efficient use of that vehicle, that one vehicle, and you're getting two trips for the price of one. And that's all because they've got better data to work on. And of course, the traditional taxi companies haven't thought of that level. I mean, a traditional taxi company typically will worry about the inventory more than the data. Uber has to worry about the data because that's what really is the lifeblood of that organisation. So the other sort of amplification area was quality control, and we all know the current scenario. You're a supplier, you provide a service to a consumer. Consumer then provides feedback back to the supplier. And what we see now, of course, in the data disruption world is that the supplier-consumer can actually have a greater impact on each other. Both can review and provide comments about each other's service, and the supplier can comment on the consumer as a consumer, how well were they a consumer. That typically doesn't happen today. If you go into an IKEA store and you buy something, IKEA doesn't say anything about you as a consumer. They don't really care. But of course, in this data disruption world, that's part of the data that is used to make decisions about reputation and trust.
Do you know, Renato, do you know if Uber actually allowed the drivers to rank the consumer and the customer.
Yes, yeah.
Do they do?
I think they do. I mean,
so when they decide whether they take up a particular customer, they actually know the record of it.
I think they've got a history of it. Yeah, they can be made available of a history. I mean, it definitely happens in Airbnb. That's one of its strengths, is you know the both sides of the equation.
Okay.
So that relationship now comes down to impacting someone's reputation on both sides of the fence, you know, as a provider and as a consumer. You can actually have a reputation now as a consumer of services, which you didn't typically have before. Typically, a consumer wasn't part of any sort of feedback loop. So Airbnb, has data, typical data. Here's an apartment in Central in Hong Kong, offered by Luca, and they have all the information about the room itself, how many bathrooms, etc. Typical data you find about any room. And then you have all the reviews. So this is where consumers who have stayed at Luca's apartment can make comments about it, individually comment, and they can also have ratings at the top there, which are starred ratings, and you can use that to determine if you want to use Luca's apartment in the future or not. One of the biggest problems that recently with Airbnb is cancelling. You know, you offer as Luca would offer his apartment, and then you're about to turn up, and then he cancels it. That's something that they're trying to move into, getting that into the quality metrics as well. But then, of course, here's Sean. Sean stayed at Luca's apartment. But Sean also offers his apartment up for rent in San Francisco. And he's got reviews as well. So this is Sean and his reviews. So he's had 34 reviews and a few other things in there. And so he's got his own review. So he's also a consumer and a supplier. And in both scenarios, there are metrics, if you like, or ratings or information about both of the experiences for enabling a consumer to come in and say, well, do I trust Sean as a renter or as a provider of services? And that really then comes down to what's often called your reputation. So your reputation is really a measurement of how much a community trusts you in some form. And there's been a lot of talk about, you know, reputation is a new currency. You can use that to trade on as well. You know, how valuable can your reputation be? And of course, it may be valuable if you have a very good reputation. That, of course, will then attract more customers to you. And so that is something of value. It's a tangible benefit to you. The interesting thing about reputation is that can it be recognised across all these services, all these data disruption services? So if Sean was to also offer his room, he also used Blah Blah Car, another one that offers a bit like Uber to rent your car. TaskRabbit, if you want to just do any task. If you want someone to put together your IKEA furniture, you go to TaskRabbit and someone will do it. That's the biggest service offering from TaskRabbit, is that guy there who will build your IKEA furniture for $45. Desks Near Me, you want to hire a desk in an office space. You can go to this one here. Lending Club, lending money, borrowing money from consumers, not from a bank, but from other people. These are all data disruption type services, and there's hundreds of them. So imagine how, if you were to be part of all of those and you had a reputation, would it follow through your reputation to the other services? So Sean runs a B&B. Is he good at lending you money, though? It's a good question. So how can we amalgamate or look at the collectiveness of those reputations, and will they make sense of putting together given the context of where they come from? What about where we sit today in the higher education sector? Can you think about how could this sector be disrupted? You know, I'm sure the taxi companies a few years ago and the hotel industries a few years ago didn't even take this on board. You know, how could we as an industry be disrupted by these new entrepreneurs? should universities ask the same question? How could they be disrupted? Looking at these types of sort of amplification areas. You know, the university is a physical place. It has lots of spare capacity during certain times that makes no money. It's idle. There's lots of rooms in university that just sit there and make no money over certain periods of time. That's an opportunity for someone to say, okay, well, I can make money on that. There's an idle resource. Someone needs it. There's a demand for it. Let me make a service that matches those together. So that's a one way, that's an example of a, you know, how you could approach this from a data disruption. From a curriculum point of view, another interesting idea, you know, a professor has a very good reputation, so can attract students. Can they offer their teaching services via some other mechanism than a traditional university? Does a student have to enrol through university to get a degree? We will say yes now, but I'm sure the Hilton and your local taxi companies said the same thing themselves. But education is interesting because it's seen as part of the knowledge economy, educating people. It's an interesting sort of area. So what is the knowledge economy? Here's a quote from over a decade ago, what the knowledge economy is. And it's really about the production of services based on knowledge-intensive activities that contribute to sort of an economy, usually at the national level, advancing with scientific advances. So the knowledge economy has a great reliance on intellectual capabilities. So our knowledge economy grows on the fact that its people have greater knowledge, typically through higher education. So here's a report that looked at the knowledge economy and asked a few questions. I won't go into all of them. And the top ones there, which of the following areas are the greatest potential for productivity gains of the next 15 years? Top one, knowledge management. So that's where the business industry said was the greatest gains to occur. And the next one was, which of the following types of roles would be most valuable to your organisation as a source of competitive advantage? It's this one here, which is a complex knowledge-based role, primarily outward-facing and required developed communication and judgment skills. So that's what's seen as the future drivers for the knowledge economy. But that report was in 2006. So we nearly 10 years ago. So you'd hope that by now that's getting close to reality. So knowledge management and knowledge-based roles are part of the new knowledge economy. And of course, the knowledge economy is something that's used a lot to promote certain sort of not only countries but also the economy itself. So here's a report, a press release that came out just recently, last year, that Asia is uniquely positioned to lead a global knowledge economy because of its characteristics of its population, the youthful population, large middle class, technology-enabled services. And then, of course, Finland also says it could be a knowledge economy, but it then puts in some interesting things about reliance on things like Nokia, reliance on a particular company that could see that challenge quite significantly. So the country relied on a particular provider of innovation to become a knowledge economy. But of course, when that provider goes away or is severely diminished, what are you left with? And the knowledge economy is all about trying to make sure that the population as a whole can be more resilient to those types of changes. So what does this all mean? I put this together as the knowledge continuum, because there's lots of ways you can view the data services and how they are managed. There's knowledge management, which one of those sort of concepts that isn't precisely defined, because on purpose you really don't know what it is unless you can see it, and someone might sell you a bit of software that does that, and then some people say no, it's more of a principles and policies around how you run an organisation. But it's typically it's typically focused on people and their knowledge and their tacit their tacit knowledge and their shared knowledge in an organization. So knowledge management with an enterprise would be about how can we share knowledge more widely through the organization so we can become a better organization, a better company. Then there's enterprise information architecture, which is really the sort of like a more of a technical view of knowledge management, and it tries to say, well, you have large organizations that are typically siloed out. How can we provide technology solutions that increases the transparency and leverages the value of all this stored digital information across the company? Then we have what we just mentioned, the knowledge economy, which is the bigger picture. How can at a national scale, how can we become a greater economy and sharing knowledge through human capital, or knowledge workers as it's called, as an innovative intellectual products, so that we can do things like have entrepreneurs who dream up a new taxi service or a new hotel service, and some countries are very focused around that entrepreneurism. And speaking to Paul just before coffee, Hong Kong is an example of that. And this weekend is the startup weekend, and where some people were coming along and doing startup companies rapidly over 48 hours or something to see how quickly they can...
54 hours,
okay. They've got an extra 6 hours here, that's all right. So what does this all mean? So if we put knowledge management and its sort of its attributes, enterprise information architecture and its attributes, the knowledge economy and its attributes. Really, what's the difference here is, and what's difference with what typically happens in more traditional organisations, is that there's a focus now on valuing information. It's saying, well, information is actually valuable. I can leverage information, I can make money out of information, I can create a better company out of information. I'm not, as opposed to, I need to worry about inventory and other traditional things. So, the meaning of data. So let's get back to data now after that knowledge in continuum view. So here's a poster that's appearing around the university at the moment. I took a photograph of it yesterday. So there's a seminar next week, actually 24th of October, on extracting meaning from data using deep analytics. And obviously this is from a health perspective. So it's always interesting to say, well, you've got data. What does it mean? How can you extract meaning from data? What does it even mean in the first place? So it's interesting to look at how those approaches would work. Can you have just raw data, atomic data, do some analytics to it, and then come up with meaning as the outcome? Is that possible and feasible? If you go back to the... what you've probably all seen before, this lovely triangle here, the data, information, knowledge, wisdom triangle, which sort of tries to very simplistically sort of look at how the progression of the meaning goes up higher. What's always been missing is how you jump from stage to stage. So my view has always been that if you add relationships to data, you get information. If you add context to information, you get knowledge. And if you add judgment to knowledge, you get wisdom. That hopefully gives you better ideas. If you're starting off here and you want to get that out of it, you need to know a bit about those and need to know that. Somehow they need to be extracted out from the raw data to get to knowledge. But what's always missing from these knowledge analytics is another triangle, of course, of a different colour. People. Always the missing part of any sort of algorithms is people. So if you add people now, if you throw in people into the mix, what does that mean? If we look up our little triangle. So if you add people to data, you end up with social media, Twitter, Facebook. And a lot of good things happen there. It amplifies some good things. It also amplifies some bad things. But that's what you get with technology. But if you add people to the next layer, you get something which we sometimes refer to as collective intelligence. Because now we're adding more and more people to something. and we're getting a collective sort of knowledge or collective intelligence. And then if you add people to that, you get something called crowd wisdom, but I put a question mark over that because I'm not sure whether that really means the wisdom of the crowd or not. But typically, I don't sort of talk about the two top layers of those triangles because it's something that's not really something easy to talk about in at a technical level. So what is this collective intelligent path that we're heading down? So in essence, it's a shared, or obviously, group intelligence that emerges from some activity. And that activity is usually collaboration. It's activities around people working together and the ability to actually work out what those people are doing at a very technical level. So not just that they're just talking, whatever, but what actually actions are they doing, what decisions are they making, what collective efforts are they doing, and what decision making are they coming up with, what consensus. And that collective intelligence really contributes quite strongly to the change of the power from the individual to the collective, for obvious reasons. So, you know, you can look at Wikipedia. There's an example of collective intelligence. A lot of people collectively editing a central resource and coming up with their own views, and in some cases, of course, having different views about a particular topic. Reputation on Airbnb is a very simple form of collective intelligence. A group of people have said, Sean is a good host for his apartment. That's collective intelligence. I could have said he's a bad host as well. But through a series of technical metrics, we can come up with a measure of how good Sean is as a B&B person. So that's very, you know, that's quite, I suppose, the starting area. But really, collective intelligence to improve business is where we want to head. How can we get to that point where we use CI to improve business outcomes? You can't manage what you can't measure. So that's always been the challenge in knowledge management and in intelligence is I can't see it, I can't touch it, I can't measure it. So if I can't measure it, how do I manage knowledge and intelligence? What do I do? And that's where you need to come up with ways, and this is where the innovation comes, is, well, how can you measure knowledge or intelligence? And particularly at the collective level, when there's lots of people doing activities, how do we measure that? So we need knowledge metrics. We need a way to quantify it. So this is almost like doing those data analytics algorithms from that poster I showed you. We can have algorithms that pore over data to try and come up with knowledge. Or we can come up with and do some pre-planning, if you like, and work out what are the metrics that I want to measure and how do I measure these metrics for my knowledge. So a couple of examples, particularly from a business point of view. Core competencies. So in an organisation, there are organisations typically have strategic competencies. Like the business wants to do something. We're a software development company, or we're a company that provides media services to news agencies or whatever they are. They have core competencies, and typically they want to be able to track how well their staff undertakes those core competencies. And you need to be able to then come up with ways to measure those so that they can obviously exploit those, typically in a good way. But more importantly, work out where their gaps are. If you want to strategically move into a new area as an organisation, if you don't have the core competencies, it's likely that you won't be very successful at that new venture. So the more you can measure your core competencies as an organisation, the better you are at strategically taking on new challenges and, of course, you know, doing opening up new business opportunities, for example. A lot of the metrics that we talk about are captured, if you like, or through platforms in social collaboration. So when people are working together and socialising online, this is from an enterprise point of view, not from a Facebook point of view, through some platforms at the organisation. They typically are non-intrusive, so you don't want to sort of intrude on the worker. That becomes the most empowering part, where we can actually start to measuring the metrics that we need to do things like work at the core competencies of an organisation. So that's really some of the challenges, and that's just one area. Another area is business processes. Business processes are a big part of a number of large enterprises. They have well-defined processes that tell you as a worker what should happen next, and what if you want to submit an order, you want to build a plane or whatever, there are business processes that you need to go through. And a lot of companies rely on large business processes to help them. Here's a report just came out end of last year from Forrester. Prediction that the age of the customer is set to disrupt the business process modelling market, the BPM. So again, disrupt customer, a particular sector. They should have predicted the disruption of the hotel industry as well, but they were too late. So if I was a BPM vendor, business process software vendor, I would be worried about what can I do to make sure my software is going to survive this disruption. So what typically will happen in this space, and this is something that our company is also working in particular process management, is that companies have their knowledge workforce have processes that are formal and informal. A formal process, of course, is described by a BPM. But then there are other things that happen around that is not captured appropriately. And that's usually by people who are smart and realise that this formal process isn't the best way of doing things. It's better to do at step 7, go off and do something else, then come back to step 8 and continue on. So that sort of deviation from a formal process is really what you want to capture from a collective point of view, and it's in some sort of social collaborative platform. So that then you can actually go back and actually change that formal process. So you capture those patterns of difference collectively, because you can't be based on a single instance. You've got to do this socially and on a collective level. And then you can improve the process, which is really what's happening up here in this prediction here, is that formal processes are too rigid and we need to use the customer or the user of that process to help that process go along. You know, a process like going to a bank and applying for a loan, for example, triggers off a big process in the background. And that typically isn't customer focused at all. It's very customer non-centric. So that's another prediction for data disruption in this industry. So what does that all mean? Go back to our original slide where we had knowledge economy, knowledge management, enterprise information architecture as part of the knowledge continuum, and they're both valuing, their focus is on valuing information. If we add collective intelligence now, what we sort of now see is that we're going to value people now. We're actually valuing the people who are part of that process to come up with better ways to improve outcomes. And we're valuing the processes themselves. We're making the processes better, which makes it more efficient and as an organisation to run. So, getting close to the end, I think, yeah. So data-driven disruption. The takeaway from this is that we have sort of knowledge, a series of knowledge artifacts, if you like. Knowledge management, enterprise information architecture, the knowledge economy. Each of these, individually, they build and help add value to an organisation. But really, the real value, the long-term value, is going to be from collective intelligence. Because that's going to build value across the complete ecosystem, the entire enterprise. And it's going to do it in such a way that when we sort of view content plus people plus processes plus social, we put those together, we put those four things together, we're going to see a much better improvement of services, much better way that we can track metrics, and a much better way that we can improve the collective quality of the services that we're offering. And of course, that then leads to the other CI, which is the capability improvement. If we can have better collective intelligence as an enterprise, strategically, then of course, as an enterprise, we have better capabilities. We can actually do better things. So we could tackle the new upcoming data disruption services. If we were a traditional organisation, we have better capabilities to change and move. Or if we are a new enterprise, we can capitalise on the fact that we have a better capability than our competitors, such as with Uber and its ability to do better scheduling of taxis, for example. Okay, so I think I wanted to end on that. Thank you for that. Hopefully it's sort of given you a very interesting ride through the knowledge continuum, and data disruption being an example of where some of these new technologies can see a path that collective intelligence is going to improve the way that organisations run and hopefully be better and more resilient in the future. So thanks very much.